in activity. Even during the ecclesiastical heyday of after the Second World War, when so many new congregations were being founded and buildings built, the number of people who were attending worship on any given weekend was declining. The post-war religious revival was not so much a revival of spiritual interest, a great awakening, as it was the testament to the emergence of suburbia, the need to transplant congregations from an urban to a suburban environment. At no time in the last two decades have more than one in five Americans been in worship on any given weekend. And over this last 50 years, there has been a steady, steady decline. Now, as I have suggested to you, I believe that we stand at one of those great cultural watersheds. A great cultural wave has risen, crested, and is now receding. The wave lasted for some two centuries. It began during the Enlightenment and grew during the 19th and the first half of our century. It was a cultural attitude which bespoke faith in man and man's abilities and man's capacities to control his destiny, to manage the future, to create with his mind and with his hands decency, a messianic age here on earth. There was no need for belief in God because man had a full belief in himself. Then came the tragedies of this century, the frustrations, the seeping, gnawing doubt that in fact life was under control. And we began to see the receding of that tide, and behind it beginning to build up a new tide in the affairs of men. A tide of spiritual concern, searching for some power greater than our own, some hope beyond the hope which was now shattered that we could, in fact, sculpt, build, machine, manage, engineer a good future. I think we are about to witness a long, long cycle of spiritual interest. But the Jewish community of which we are a part has been formed by the age, the humanist age, the Enlightenment age, the secularist age. And it's a Jewish community which, like most of the other communities of the West, is characterized largely by religious listlessness. Not by anger at the religious enterprise, but simply by indifference. Religion has been for some time now a matter for grandfathers and grandsons, for older folk and for unliberated women. But the best and the brightest have found their faith and their philosophies and have placed their energies elsewhere. I think that spirit is about to end. But if we want to understand ourselves, the state of our faith, we are still children of this secularist age. And if Judaism had had to survive in America over the last half century on the basis of its own internal attractiveness, or rather on the basis of your and my abilities to respond to the age-old wisdom of our people, I'm afraid that most Jews would have long since disappeared into that great American middle-class anonymity with which so many, for which so many seem to have sought. We did not respond over the last half century to the religious word, to the religious moment, to the celebration. And yet we stand paradoxically in 1974, the time when the American Jewish community has never been stronger, better organized, able to claim as its own a larger percentage of those who are born Jews or who have joined the Jewish community. paradox is that 50 years ago, when there was more faith, there was less community. And today, where there is less faith, there is more community. More Jews wear the label Jew proudly, openly. More Jews are active with more Jewish business than were ever active in the 1920s and the 1930s. Then it was the Zionist few who were working with all their might for a Jewish state. And there was some kind of larger concern with refugees, but it was cloaked largely in humanitarian interests and language, not in especially Jewish interests and language. How shall we explain ourselves to ourselves? More importantly, how shall we explain ourselves to our children? We are a paradoxical community. Community born not so much of internal religious needs, but of external political pressures. If you want to understand why the Jewish community is what it is today, you must understand what the world has been these last 50 years for the Jew. It's been a time of terrible, terrifying crisis. Stalin, the purges, the doctor's trial of Hitler, the Europe which was to be Judenrein, Dachau, Auschwitz. It was the time of the British White Papers, immigration of Jews to Palestine became illegal. It was a time in which the great democracies of the West closed their doors to large-scale Jewish in-migration and held hypocritical conferences about Jewish refugees. It was a time during which, after the Second World War, despite the evidence of the death camps, 2 million Jews were kept for months and years in displaced persons camps, homeless, rootless. It's been a time of 4 Arab wars, the displacement of nearly 2 million Oriental Jews. It's been a terrible and terrifying half-century for the Jews. And Jews who would openly say they are non-religious or indifferent to matters religious have found that they couldn't be indifferent to the plight of their families, of those who bore the same label. And so the needs of Jewish survival, an increasingly stubborn determination that the forces of violence and oppression in the world will not have their way, these have forged the Jewish community and made for the level of activity, of concern, of involvement which we note all about us today. And obviously they've also made for the paradoxical quality of that community. We insist on numbering them ourselves as a religious community among Protestants and Catholics. That's where we Jews belong, not among Hungarians or Italians or Irish, but among the religious groups of America. And yet when we organize our communities, we deliberately exclude all religious issues from that organization, lest they be divisive. And when we choose leaders for our organizations, we hardly give a passing glance at their highest concerns or their religious learning. We ask only if their effectiveness, their power, their wealth, their social position, their willingness to be involved with us in the issues of survival. It is not to say that the religious enterprise has not been sustained over the past century. Obviously it has, by the congregations and by the schools and in many other ways. But it's not been where the action was. It's not been where the Jew was willing to put his energies or his heart or his concern. And so the modern Jew finds himself in the position of being terribly involved in the survival of Jews, and wondering why his children say to him, well, what is the real difference between the survival of Jews in Israel or in the Soviet Union and the survival of blacks and decency in America or of Indians or the survival of the people of Bangladesh or of any other oppressed, impoverished group throughout the world. When the young son, the young daughter, asks his parents, one way or another, why should I be involved as you are involved in this Jewish enterprise? The parent comes to the rabbi and to the religious school and says to us, why don't you teach them more about the Nazis? Why don't you teach them more about Israel? And of course we do talk about the Holocaust, and we do talk a great deal about Israel, all that she stands for. What the parent is really saying to us is this. I can remember those days in 1945 when the camps were thrown open. I still can't look at those pictures of the heaped up bodies in the ovens. They were Jews, after all. And I remember the thrill that I received when I stood for the first time in Israel and thought of the pioneers and of the farms and the kibbutzim and of the valor of the Haganah. What he's really saying to me is, why don't my children feel the same way? And if I say to him, well, how did you feel in religious school when we talked to you about Haman or about Torquemada? Didn't they seem like the far distant past? And mustn't these experiences, which are so vital to you, seem like the far distant past to your children? He shakes his head in bemusement and wonders, you know, how quickly history becomes medieval. Now, of recent date, parents and children have found that the gap of understanding about what it means to fight for Jewish survival has narrowed. Since the October War of 1973, since a few years before the rise of old-fashioned anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union, since the strutting of Arafat before the United Nations, almost anyone who is conscious and a Jew has recognized the age-old tensions and fears and the demands on his soul and his energy. We seem to stand again as we stood in the 30s and in the 40s. But the problem remains. Whenever Jewish life settles down, the problem is there. What positive content can being Jewish have for me? Why should I be concerned about intermarriage? Why should I be concerned about living a Jewish life? Why should I be concerned about the religious or Jewish education of my children? What positive content can being Jewish have for me? Yes, I'll fight for Jewish causes, but is that enough? I asked the confirmation class the other day, your children and your grandchildren, what differences they found between Jewish values and American values. And they found none. They didn't even understand my question. Which is to say that in your homes and in the homes of your children, there is nothing that is significantly different from what your children expect to find in the homes of their non-Jewish friends' parents. Now, obviously, all human beings are human beings with the same needs. But every religious tradition, every great cultural tradition, certainly the covenant faith which is ours, has had certain values about human dignity and community and family and learning, which are different than those of the host culture. But somehow the children did not sense it, did not find it. It is either never not there, and if it is there, it is simply not discussed. To them, the only difference between a Jew and a non-Jew is that we light Hanukkah candles and they have a Christmas tree. It is superficial, ceremonial, a matter of calendar, not a matter of conscience or principle. And until we Jews find ways of making clear to ourselves first and then to our children the positive content of being Jewish for us, how it has made us different, better as human beings, how it has given grace, dignity, meaning to our lives, we cannot expect this American Jewish community, this diaspora community, to go on with any strength for any period of time. Yes, we can say to ourselves, if we're satisfied with this kind of argument, God works in mysterious ways. If it were not for the continuing pressures of the Arabs against Israel, the competing, culturally varied community of refugees who have come into Israel would not have been forged into a single national unity with a national consciousness, a sense of identity. If it had not been for all the pressures which have been felt worldwide by Jews, the Jewish community of the United States would not have been conscious of its identity, and I suppose there's a certain truth to this. Perhaps we can satisfy ourselves with an old, rather realistic, Rabbinic adage, mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma, that sometimes what we come to do for one reason we end up doing for the full reason, which is the observation that many who have become involved in United Jewish Appeal, in defense in Israel, and the creation of a pro-Jew lobby, have found that they have been stimulated by Jewish literature, that they respond to Jewish moments, their lives are the richer for it. But until for most of us we find or found the institutions, the schools, the homes, in which there is a positive content to being Jewish, good vibrations, significant vibrations, until then we will not have come to grips with the problems, the possibilities of Jewish survival. And I'd like the remainder of the time today and next week to suggest how this can be done and how this, I think, should not be done. I've already suggested that one of the modulations which may allow some Jews significance is the traditional one, the Orthodox one. It is consistent, it is distinct, it has shape, it has bite, it has a discipline, it has appeal to those who can abide by its authority. It is a survival instrument for those who live within it. But we're not Orthodox Jews, and so let me concentrate on those options which seem open to us. And the one which I think we may be tempted to take, and the one which I think it would be disastrous to take, is the one which I should like to place before you today. I call it Judaism Begins With Me. This long humanist secularist tidal wave, of which I have spoken, began in the Enlightenment, in a period of time in which men enthroned two ideas, two words, the idea of nature and the idea of reason. No political or social structure institution which was artificial should be allowed to have authority over man. All the complicated rights and obligations of the feudal structure were to be brushed aside for a natural covenanted community in which men gave over to the government only such rights as the government by necessity had to discharge, and all else would remain within the ambit of human freedom. And man was not to be bound by any authority, imperial, ecclesiastic, revelationary, but by his own reason. He was to look, to see, to judge, and to make his own judgments. At the end of the 18th century and going on into the 19th and into our own century, men broke free of the authority of the church, of the authority of the ancient revealed traditions, and beginning with Kant's categorical imperative, demanded for themselves the right to make judgments in all moral issues, on all moral issues, based on their own understanding of the equity and the justice of the situation. I will not take orders from anyone. I will not accept anyone's discipline. I will work it out for myself. Freedom, freedom of conscience, freedom of act, freedom to do anything which does not impinge upon another's freedom, became the conventional wisdom of modern man. Modern man celebrates this freedom. And when he is forced to find some kind of philosophic or anthropological justification for it, he speaks of the infinite possibilities of the human soul. He celebrates human possibility. He celebrates freedom. And he argues that he will not be trammeled, not be shackled by anyone else's authority, any institutions, any authority. He will work out his destiny for himself. Now, more than we care to admit, we are all creatures still of this humanist philosophy. If we call a service a prayer book service, a few will come. We call it a creative service, service etched in freedom, more will come. We say that we will have a class session where the wisdom of man, of this or that part of our tradition or of any tradition will be discussed, will be lectured on, a few will come. If we call a rap session where we exchange our ignorance and our instincts of the moment, more will come. Modern man is in many ways meshuggah for the idea of freedom. He wants to throw away the past, its institutions, its values, its literature. And he wants to filter life only through himself, through his own experience. And he wants the privilege of developing the future based on his own judgments. Now the problem is that the human soul is not infinitely benevolent, simply good, perverse only because mankind imposes a bad environment, the street, the ghetto, bad parental upbringing upon him. We don't know what is within the human soul. There is sweetness and love and empathy, and there is violence and cruelty and a sadistic tendency. The human soul may have an infinite capacity to love. It also has infinite capacity to be spiteful. It may have an infinite capacity to be empathetic. It also has an infinite ego. The human soul is not the repository of all that is potentially good. It is the repository of all that is potentially us. And we are complex creatures. Creatures of good impulse, of evil impulse, petulant and thoughtful, considerate and intemperate alike. If we want to celebrate the human spirit, let's recognize the kind of radical leap of faith that we are in fact making. Where in the history of the human race do we find a single example of a man or of a woman of infinite goodness? Where in the history of the human race do we find a single example of a person, a human being who is not complex, good and evil, egotistic and unselfish, active and passive, violent and peaceful at the same time, or in the same life? It's time, I think, that we, all of us, rethink the assumptions about freedom, human reasonableness, and the celebration of the human spirit, which we're tempted to undertake. The human spirit is all that we have to deal with, but it's wonderful and frightening at the same time. Very much like God. Awesome and loving. What I'm suggesting is this. There are those among us, both within the congregations, the liberal and conservative congregations, and outside, would like to say that since religion is a complex, problematic structure, and since we can't prove any single religious statement, and there'll always be somebody who'll stand up and say the opposite, the only thing that we can claim is that religion ought to celebrate the human spirit, and the only dogma of religion ought to be the dogma of religious freedom. That man will use the moment, the meeting, the celebration, in order to find to tap the deepest and profoundest resources within himself. Don't tell me about Maimonides or Akiba or Moses. Don't shackle me with the holidays, the dietary laws, the traditions. I am a Jew, which means simply I am a human being committed to the infinite possibilities of life. And I will use my reason and I will use such judgment as I possess in order to develop those possibilities. Now what is dangerous here is that it repeats the language, the outdated, archaic, now medieval language of the last 2 centuries. The faith in man. Who of us can still hold that faith fully? The faith in reason, as if Freud had never taught and never worked. The faith in human judgment, as if we do not make different judgments when we are lonely and when we are full of love, when we are tired and when we are energetic, when we are young and when we are old. What we seem to want to escape when we justify human reason and celebrate freedom is discipline. The discipline of family, the discipline of community, the discipline of traditional ethical standards, the discipline of the covenant between God and man, between God and Israel. We don't like the word discipline. Modern man tries to avoid it at all costs. When I hear parents talking with children, if I hear them talking in terms of ethical theory, and I very rarely do, what I hear is this: you can do anything you want, provided you don't hurt somebody else. Now that's not an ethical category. That's simply the categorization of indulgence. You can do anything you want, provided you don't hurt anybody else. Not, you should do something with your life. You ought to love another, care for another, empathize with others. God gave you talents and you're stewards of them, and you ought to place them in such a way that they will be of benefit to others? Oh, no. As long as you ski down the mountain, you don't hit somebody else. That's all that's needed. Modern man is indulgent with himself, but not as indulgent with others. Modern man uses this term freedom to justify his indulgence. He speaks of himself in terms which ancient men more wisely reserved for God. As if deep within we are infinitely wise and infinitely able and infinitely good, and we are simply not that. Somehow or other, there is nothing more arrogant than the assumption that history begins with us. That we're a different breed somehow. That we've escaped because of our understanding or our philosophy or our degrees or our learning from the superstitions of the past, and that we are going to be able to break through to a new level of sensitive living, of caring, community organization, of political life, which man has never owned before. We're not going to be able to. Life is infinitely tragic. Imagine a time when our dramatists and literary folk are telling us, in fact, that in their eyes, life often seems simply absurd. I don't know quite Are you and I children of decades of prosperity? Children who have enjoyed the freedom of a land which seemed infinitely open? Children who've enjoyed the freedom of the most powerful land on the face of the earth? Children of a time in which we were told in a thousand ways of human capacity and human ability, in which we averted our glance from the evidence of human cupidity and human violence? I don't know quite how we're going to recover the importance of discipline in our lives, but we had better. A weed is that which grows free in the garden. A flower is cultivated. A monster is a child who has grown free. A human being is a child who has civilized himself and been civilized, socialized by family, community, school. Only a religious structure which makes demands of discipline, not just the lighting of an occasional candle, but moral discipline, spiritual discipline, only such a faith will have any chance of being meaningful to us in the long, long years of this new spiritual age which is dawning. Next week, I'd like to suggest those disciplines and that possibility to you. Today, I'd like simply to leave you with a traditional image. Judaism believes in freedom. What is the Exodus? I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of bondage, out of the land of Egypt. But we believe in freedom within covenant. We believe in freedom within an accepted set of principles, of disciplines. 3 days after the Jews had been brought out of Egypt, they were brought to Sinai, and they were given the law. And those 3 days were among the most anarchic and violent and undisciplined days in all of our history. 3 short days, the Jews began to rebel against Moses, take us back to the flesh pots in Egypt. It's one thing to feel ourselves free, and ultimately we must be free men and women who make some free decisions, but within a certain limits, within the ambit of certain disciplines. Judaism affirms the Exodus, but Judaism really begins with Sinai. Freedom allows us to be responsible, but it's the responsibilities which allow us to be human beings.